is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Good governance, very difficult to establish in Libya. There's arms everywhere, militias everywhere. There's no rule of law. So the presence of foreign powers has really undermined that.
That was Aya Barwila, a visiting lecturer at the Hellenic National Defense College on the need to create stability in Libya. Details coming up. Also, UN Human Rights Council accuses the Eritrean government of involvement in Ethiopia's conflict in the Tigray region. And there is fear that Southern Africa could become a base for terrorist groups. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Monday's election in Ethiopia was the sixth since the overthrow of Mengistu Haile Mariam's communist government in 1991. The previous five were all won by the now disbanded Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front's four-party alliance. The twice postponed elections were overshadowed by warnings of famine and mounting reports of atrocities in the war-hit northern region of Tigray, along with growing international concerns over whether the elections would be fair. U.S. State Department cited detention of opposition politicians, harassment of independent media, partisan activities by local and regional governments, and the many inter-ethnic and intercommunal conflicts across Ethiopia. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the historic significance of these elections.
The elections are historic in that they're a move towards democracy in a country that has never genuinely had competitive election. And so to the extent that they can do so with a country of a population of 110 million people, that's a big deal and an important inflection point potentially for Ethiopian history. It also sets a precedent for how leaders at all levels of Ethiopia's federal system should be selected. And so it has the potential to add more voice and participation in Ethiopia's electoral process than it's ever had before. So it is highly historic. At the same time, as you note, there are many complicating factors in Ethiopia. You know, all transitional elections are complicated, and this one is even more so by the fact that you have the conflict in Tigray, and so that is preventing any participation from that region. You have the unfolding famine in the north. You have the genie of ethnic federalism that was released by the previous government, and which has amplified and incentivized ethnic divisions in the country. And so you're having these historical elections while at the same time you have all these fragmenting pressures on the country and challenges just to keep it together. So there's a lot to navigate and be a lot to try to unpack as we see the outcome from the elections.
Despite Abiy Ahmed's pledges of fair and free elections, there were growing international concerns over whether the elections will be fair. The European Union has said it will not observe the vote after its request to import communication equipment were denied by the Ethiopian government. Last week, the United States State Department said it is gravely concerned about the environment under which these elections are being held, citing detention of opposition politicians, harassment of independent media, partisan activities by local and regional governments, and the many inter-ethnic and intercommunal conflicts across Ethiopia. How could that impact the legitimacy of these elections?
Well, to the extent that the elections are not seen as free and fair by Ethiopians, it will undermine the potential legitimacy-enhancing benefits that the elections could bring to the government, whichever government emerges from these elections. I think it is important to recognize that the federal government is fending off several armed separatist movements during these elections, and some of these armed movements have vowed to try to undermine the electoral process. So there are, you know, a number of extenuating circumstances for multiple sides that are affecting the inclusiveness of these elections. And so I think we should go into these elections expecting them to be far from perfect. I think it's also important to recognize that if the government were to delay the election again, then they would also come in for a lot of criticism as having prolonged their time in power unconstitutionally. And so I think the key question we want to be looking at is, are these elections qualitatively more participatory and more transparent than what Ethiopia has had in the past? In other words, are they moving in the right direction? You know, in this way, I'm reminded of the sequence of events we observed in Nigeria following their 1999 move towards multipartyism. And, you know, those first few elections after its shift towards democratic systems did not go that well. There were a lot of criticisms for them not meeting international standards. Yet they got better each time, and they became increasingly competitive. By 2015, we actually saw change in parties through the electoral process. So I think in Ethiopia's case, the key question is, are we moving in the right direction towards precedents and better standards for more competitive and participatory electoral processes?
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. A report submitted to the UN Human Rights Council accuses the Eritrean government of involvement in Ethiopia's conflict in the Tigray region and of committing serious human rights violations against Eritreans who have sought asylum in Tigray. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights Situation in Eritrea, Mohamed Abdel Salam Babiker, is new to the job, although in 2017, he was part of a UN monitoring team that imposed sanctions on the country. In this, his first report since he started his mandate in November, he pulls no punches. He presents a grim picture of a government that perpetrates gross human rights violations with impunity, both at home and abroad.
There are no tangible signs of progress or concrete evidence of improvement in the internal human rights situation in Eritrea. In addition, Eritrea extended its human rights violations extraterritorially or beyond its borders during this mandate and committed heinous human rights violations in the Tigray region of Ethiopia.
Babaker says he has received allegations that Eritrean troops in Tigray carried out deliberate attacks against civilians, summary executions, sexual and gender-based violence. He says they also allegedly took part in the abduction and disappearance of Eritrean refugees and asylum seekers. He expresses particular concern about the reported destruction by Eritrean troops of two refugee camps in Hitsats and Shimbela in northern Tigray, which hosted more than 25,000 Eritrean refugees. The refugee camps are located near the two countries' borders.
I call on the Eritrean authorities to withdraw their forces from Tigray to provide information about the whereabouts of the missing Eritrean refugees and to release any Eritrean refugees held in detention.
Turning to the situation inside Eritrea, Babaker says the only positive news he has to report is of the release of more than 100 Muslims, Orthodox Christians, and Jehovah's Witnesses who were detained without charges and trial, some for over 20 years. He's urging the government to release all political prisoners and prisoners of conscience who are being held incommunicado for indefinite periods under inhumane conditions. In his response to Babaker, Ambassador Tesfamikael Geratu of Eritrea's Ministry of Foreign Affairs made no reference to Eritrean troop presence in Ethiopia. He rejected the report, calling it politicized. He called into question the legitimacy of the special rapporteur's mandate and told the council it should be abolished. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
International law enforcement agencies and governments in southern Africa are becoming increasingly concerned about the potential for terrorist groups to use the region as a base. They're particularly concerned about South Africa, one of the continent's most developed countries with logistics, communications technology, banking, and other infrastructure appealing to terrorist organizations. Darren Taylor reports.
The recent rise of a group loyal to Islamic State, or ISIS, in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province has awoken the world to the threat of extremism in southern Africa. But an expert on security challenges in Africa, Stephen Buchanan Clark, believes the dangers existed for decades.
Khalfan Khamis Mohammed, a Tanzanian trained by Al-Qaeda, was arrested in Cape Town in 2000 for his role in the 1998 U.S. embassy bombings by Al-Qaeda in Tanzania and Kenya.
For the past few months, Buchanan Clark has interviewed intelligence and other security officials for research for the Good Governance Africa organization on terror groups in southern Africa.
These organizations operate in a very transnational manner. So while transnational terrorist groups may launch attacks in one country, they may operate across multiple nodes in different countries.
Buchanan Clark believes the presence of extremist networks in South Africa in particular is significantly wider than previously assumed.
It is clear that South Africa has been used as a hub for international terrorist activity, including a base from which to plan attacks, a conduit for illicit financial transactions, and a place of hiding and transit for international terrorist actors. And these earliest incidents date back even before 9/11, actually.
He says several cases in recent years show this, such as the arrests in 2009 in Durban of 19 people who attacked a Shia mosque and were planning to plant bombs across the city. Buchanan Clark also points to the convictions of Islamic State supporters Brandon and Tony Tulsi in 2016 in Johannesburg on 11 counts of contravening the country's Terrorist Act.
These included planning bombings on various sites within South Africa, including Jewish centers, Jewish high schools, government buildings, and British and American embassies.
Then in 2018, Saifuddin Del Vecchio, his wife Fatima Patel, and their Malawian border, Ahmad Musa, were arrested in Durban on charges including kidnapping and murder. They go on trial in August for this and for allegedly planning several acts of terror.
In all three cases, the individuals were in contact with ISIS recruiters, very sophisticated networks of encrypted social media platforms. They were receiving and sending financing money abroad, and in one case that included cryptocurrencies. And they all were utilizing open-sourced online terrorist training material and propaganda, which is frankly almost impossible at this stage for security services to intercept and to stop.
Buchanan Clark's research reveals that roughly 100 South Africans left their homeland since 2015 to join ISIS in Iraq, Syria, and Libya, and about 75 are back in the country.
This is confirmed in the National Prosecuting Authority's annual report, which states that activities involving both domestic groups and South Africans involved with international terrorist organizations increased in 2019 and 2020. And this was also revealed to me in discussions with members of the security sector and practitioners in the field.
A senior South African intelligence officer told VOA it would be stupid to think that scores of individuals trained by IS in the Middle East, including in the field of explosives, have returned to the country to suddenly live in peace and tolerance, as he put it. So, he says, the extremists are being monitored closely. The officer adds his colleagues have already established possible connections between local Islamist terror cells and jihadists in northern Mozambique. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Analysts say Turkey is expected to come under pressure to remove its military from Libya when world leaders gather tomorrow at a conference in Berlin. The meeting will include discussions on elections and the withdrawal of foreign forces from the war-torn northern African country. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Wednesday's Berlin Conference is the second international meeting organized by Germany and the United Nations. Discussions will be on permanently ending the Libyan civil war and preparations for December elections. A key goal of the gathering is the creation of a framework for the withdrawal of all foreign fighters, something Aya Buela, a visiting lecturer at the Hellenic National Defense College, says is key to restoring stability.
good governance. Very difficult to establish in Libya. There's arms everywhere, militias everywhere, there's no rule of law. So the presence of foreign powers has really undermined that. So Libyans want them all out. They want to have a normal country. Most of all, they want to have elections at the end of the year.
Turkey deployed hundreds of soldiers and thousands of Syrian fighters in support of the Libyan government of national accord in its battle against forces of Libya's General Khalifa Haftar, who is backed by Russian and Sudanese mercenaries. A ceasefire is now in force. While backing calls for the removal of foreign troops, Ankara says its presence is legitimate because it was invited by the internationally recognized government. But with conference attendees, including EU members and the United States, calling for the removal of all foreign troops and Turkey seeking to improve ties with its Western allies, international relations professor Serhat Güvenç of Istanbul's Kadahas University says Ankara will likely acquiesce, at least in part.
Turkey will probably eventually come to terms with the fact that it has to, you know, take those foreign fighters from Libya, you know, the Syrian, the fighters, you know, the Turkish proxies.
A U.S. Defense Department report last year said Turkey sent thousands of paid Syrian fighters to Libya. Buela says the mercenaries are among the most destabilizing forces in Libya.
These Syrian mercenaries, their behavior in Libya is very much the same as their behavior in northeast Syria. Looting, sexual assaults, violence. And there's something very jarring about natives seeing foreign men with arms, you know, driving around their streets, you know, no accountability.
Ankara denies such claims of misconduct. Turkey's wider military presence is also expected to come under pressure. The Turkish military constructed an air base and wants to establish a naval base in Libya, a plan opposed by Egypt and France, which are also attending the Berlin conference. But Güvenç says Ankara sees its Libyan military presence as having strategic importance.
Turkey has to keep a foot in Africa, that air force base or air base in Alwatia. In Libya, indeed, offers tremendous opportunities in that regard. So probably Turkey will bargain really hard to keep its presence, keep that base.
Analysts say the Berlin conference sees Ankara working to balance its strategic goals of improving ties with its Western allies while expanding its influence in Africa. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Arab media are reporting that Libya's coastal highway is closed again following declarations by the National Unity Government that the road was now open. The Tripoli-based government has been pushing hard to reopen the road, arguing that it is a sign of the country's reunification. Military and political leaders in eastern Libya argue that reopening the road may allow terrorists to flow into their sector. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Arab media reported the highway was closed again as of Monday afternoon, a day after National Unity Prime Minister Abdul Hamid Dbeiba declared the road had officially been reopened. A video from the Reuters news agency showed Prime Minister Dbeiba in a tractor Sunday removing earth from the coastal highway to reopen the road. The road connects the western city of Misrata and Sirte, the hometown of late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. General Ahmed al-Masmari, the spokesman for Eastern Military Commander General Khalifa Haftar, said the prime minister and militia forces around Tripoli had overstepped their legal authority, circumventing a 10-person joint military committee authorized to make that decision. The UN-appointed committee, known as 5 plus 5, includes an equal number of military officers from both sides. He says that Unity Prime Minister Dbeiba tried to go around the committee that has responsibility for deciding whether to open the coastal highway. He argued that a regional militia used bribery to force its reopening. A Libyan military official in the town of Sirte, who belongs to the committee, told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV that the group was not willing to reopen the road unless and until all security measures have been taken. Egyptian analyst Saeed Sadiq, now in Tunisia, tells VOA that both Egypt and Turkey have been playing hardball in Libya to prevent the other side from gaining the upper hand. Egypt generally supports General Haftar, but has opened up to the Tripoli government, while Turkey supports the Tripoli government, but has made no effort to open up to the military in eastern Libya or those political forces.
There is tension between Egypt and Turkey. The Turkish Minister of Defense and Chief of Staff and Intelligence paid a very big visit to Tripoli. And immediately you had the Egyptian intelligence chief visiting Tripoli and then visiting Haftar. So they are balancing.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi said Sunday during a visit by Libyan Foreign Minister Nejla al-Mangoush that the security of Egypt is tied to the security of Libya. He added during a visit to Greece Monday that Cairo is opposed to meddling by outside forces to manipulate the will of the Libyan people. He says that Egypt is supporting Libya in its objective to hold elections when they are supposed to be held at the end of this year and opposes any roadblocks that are put up by foreign forces to stop that from happening. Libya analyst Aya Burwaila, who teaches at the Hellenic National Defense College, tells VOA that Prime Minister Dabeiba, who has now been in office for 3 months, has made no appreciable efforts towards fulfilling his duties to expel foreign forces and unify domestic institutions. She says that pushing for the coastal road to open without the green light from the 5+5 committee raises concerns that thousands of Syrian mercenaries and Islamist militant groups will make their way to the east to carry out attacks against civilians and the army. Meanwhile, talks on Libya are set to open later this week in Germany. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The Voice of America's global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the internet.